I'm Anna Lutfi and this is The Verdict, brought to you by the Dixon Poon School of Law, King's College London. The Verdict is a radical experiment in legal podcasting. We bring law closer to home in a world where legislation, regulation and the courts seem increasingly remote to the general public. And this week I spoke to Professor Frederick Mostert, who's a professor of practice at the Dixon Poon School of Law at King's College London. He's also a research fellow at the Oxford Intellectual Property Research Centre at the University of Oxford. He's a research fellow at the Research Centre for Intellectual Property Law at Tsinghua University School of Law in Beijing. He notably provided pro bono legal assistance to the late President Nelson Mandela of South Africa. And his opinion pieces have been published widely and are featured regularly in the Financial Times and the South China Morning Post. He's co-founder of the Aequitas Project, which we're going to discuss today. It involves international collaboration with intellectual property experts to create what's being discussed as a new human rights charter that's fit for our digital age. Professor Mostert explained to The Verdict why the world needs a digital Magna Carta, and it needs one soon. Dr. Mostert, thanks for joining us at The Verdict. This is a taster podcast to introduce you and introduce you to our listeners, to your work, and to talk about two initiatives that you've been closely involved with. One is the Digital Scholarship Institute, and the other is Aequitas. Would you agree that these are digital human rights projects?
Yes, very much so. Although we started out on the basis of intellectual property rights, we very quickly developed into something much larger. As we know, it's very much an integrated world in the digital world. So yes, I would very much say these avenues that we are exploring and researching is based in human rights.
So what are digital human rights?
Well, I would like to think it's a very large and broad spectrum. If you think things through, the online world has really amplified things that happen in the offline world, so that it amplifies the virality, the velocity, and the volume of content online amplifies what happens in the real world. And to my mind, which has become of great concern, especially as I was doing research more and more in the last 4 to 5 years, I've discovered how much it's impacted our lives through the online world, but particularly human rights.
Can you give an example of a human rights area that has arisen as a result of what you have described, you know, this explosion?
Yes, I think the thing that has and still concerns me greatly is the enormous explosion in the area of online sexual abuse. So as we know, that has been there in the offline world to a great extent, but it's certainly amplified. And the New York Times did a really insightful and in-depth piece on this with empirical evidence to show that in less than a 10-year period, online sexual abuse has grown from 1 million to 18 million cases, which demonstrates the issue. I think another parallel issue too is human trafficking. Human trafficking has been enabled, as a United Nations report has pointed out, and has been enabled through online content and content on social media platforms in particular.
That's very interesting, given that I know you to be, and many know you to be, an advocate of free speech protections. And I'm wondering how one balances regulation of clearly harmful and abusive content and criminal conduct online with our freedoms to express ourselves and to exchange information and materials without undue state interference. Would you say that's a big issue?
Yes, it's a very big issue. You put me to the post. I was just about to mention free speech. And I give you a classic example which comes to mind. Is if you look at the lone free speech activist in authoritarian states, he or she would need to express themselves. And for that to happen online, they need anonymity. So it should be very carefully protected in those jurisdictions. And the World Wide Web does to some extent facilitate it, but not sufficiently enough. And it's those type of areas where free speech really needs to be protected to the umpteenth extent. But there are many other areas. But I would like to think that, for instance, if you give you another example, is with creative people, creative spirits online, their freedom of expression is so blunted and so muted in many instances where they, for instance, would create musical compositions, novels, artistic expression in terms of poetry, paintings, whatever, and they would be taken down by what we refer to as algorithmic takedowns or robotic takedowns. So there is enormous overblocking of creative content where there is at the same time underblocking of other areas of human rights, such as sexual child abuse and human trafficking. So it shows you over and underblocking by social media platforms, which really points to the fact that there is something wrong with the way in which the social media platforms, and in general, not just the platforms, but society deals with the current tensions, the fundamental tensions in this area of how to deal with content moderation.
You're an intellectual property lawyer. Would you describe yourself as such? I think in that sense, you've given us a really good window into how, from a small niche part of the law, there is this intersection with huge and burning questions in our society about how we regulate ourselves globally and online, but also in relation to criminal behaviour as well. So we need collaboration on a massive interdisciplinary level, don't we, to address these problems? And I believe that's something you are involved in closely with these two projects that I mentioned at the start, Equitas and the Digital Scholarship Institute. Would you say those are examples of international collaboration, individuals coming together from different disciplines to tackle the big questions?
Yes, that's exactly how those initiatives came about. About 4 or 5 years ago, as most things happen by way of accident, we were sitting around the table at informal seminars, a number of us, and most of us, quite interestingly, come from an intellectual property perspective. And my theory is, which I think to some extent is borne out by practice, is that many of these digital tools that we use, for instance, the notice and takedown procedure was created in the copyright arena by the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the US, they have all branched out into other areas. For instance, they're very important with things like child sexual abuse and in other areas of the law. So the tools themselves, I would think, emanated from the intellectual property area, online, digital, and then went into other areas. But you cannot look at things in a pigeonhole fashion in today's world. Things are so interrelated. So I would constantly demonstrate that if you look at these issues, online issues, they typically are not only legal issues. They start with tech and big tech in particular. You need to have some understanding of how those issues work. You need to look at things like ethics. You need to look at philosophy. You need to look at psychographic studies on sociology online. So these are all interrelated. It's almost impossible not to look at them in a holistic fashion. And as you just said, I think it's so crucial to keep in mind that by definition, the internet is global, it's international, and you can't fragment the internet, although there have been efforts and they have not been that entirely successful, with a few exceptions, of course. But to look at these things from an international perspective is so crucial. So if you look at how new norms are created, and we love the new term, new normal. How are these new norms created on the internet, and how do you deal with this, with that, as I were, large scale, that large canvas of different disciplines? Is really important to look at it from a global perspective, almost in the old traditional sense of natural law. The Roman law referred to natural law more in the sense of these are principles that we as humans hold dear throughout the world, and some very basic issues are the same to all of us. So in our area that we are discussing right now, child sexual abuse, obviously, And there has been, as we all know, this very successful international effort on child sexual abuse and in other areas. And one of them, I believe, is in this area where we are dealing with the Equitas principles that we launched last month ago, and to a great extent, one of the first forays of the Digital Scholarship Institute in a public way.
Fascinating stuff. Now, you mentioned the Equitas principles, so maybe you could just very briefly explain to the listeners what you mean by the Equitas principles and who you're working with, or not everybody, but some of the colleagues that you're working with through the Digital Scholarship Institute, because, as I said, this is a taster podcast, and we're hoping to get you and some of your colleagues together for a follow-up to talk about these big issues in more detail with some more concrete proposals as to how they may be tackled. So just to go back to the Equitas principles, are you able to clarify what you mean by those and what you're working on with your colleagues currently?
Yes. If I could just start with the Digital Scholarship Institute, we are 22 professors and scholars from around the world. And as I said, this came about very informally. We were starting to discuss we could see 4 or 5 years ago, things would come down the pipe where governments will start regulating content moderation. So we started talking and discussing these, and we said, well, for those things to happen in a fashion where we are, all of us, I think, are at heart believers that, as Sir John Postel, and Sir Tim Berners-Lee and Vince Cerf had indicated at the beginning of the World Wide Web and the internet, that this would be a glorious environment where information would flow freely, scientific data would be exchanged, and businesses could go international. But I think those initial founders of the web and the internet, like all of us, did not realize that you would see the best of humanity and the worst of humanity on the web. So there has been a real relook at how you need to deal with these rather unfortunate issues that have popped up on the web, especially in the last number of years. And with that in mind, we said, well, the best way would be to some extent, study these underlying tensions between human rights and the issues on the web, and provide guidance in the form of principles. And although there are some other principles out there, we thought that one would need to look at, as we discussed earlier, cross-disciplinary look at these issues. And so that was the beginnings of drafting the Equitas principles, the online principles. And as with all good things in life, when I suggested that we do these things and set up the Digital Scholarship Institute, I was told by my colleagues, because I had proposed this, I should volunteer to start the process. So we did put that together. And here we are. So we only launched the Equitas principles a month ago, which, by the way, is available online at equitas.online. Equitas spelled A-E-Q-U-I-T-A-S. And essentially, what the Equitas principles really aim at achieving is provide essentially that guidance, as it were, almost an infrastructure, an architecture for the web to deal with these issues and how to deal with those tensions, which we think there was a gap, a lacuna in this area of the law and in these other disciplines. So essentially, we are talking about due process principles, including procedural fairness and natural justice, that should guide the design and implementation of platform processes so that human rights, fundamental freedoms, and the rule of law are restored and maintained in the online environment. I think one metaphor to use is, if you think of the progress of science in the late 1800s, when the railways first came about to provide infrastructure in countries around the world, you had the locomotives. And so the locomotives just ran and they created fires for the farmers, and fire breaks had to be built. And how do you deal with the fallout of new technology? We're in the same position now. And as the tracks were the infrastructure and the architecture for these locomotives to run, I think the same is true here. We've got the web and we have the locomotives, but we don't have the infrastructure and the architecture. And we think that something like the due process principles provide that type of backbone, which is so important, as we know in the offline world, has been around with us since the Magna Carta. And that's something that we really need to obviously adapt, but we need that architecture for the web.
It's interesting you mentioned the Magna Carta, because I was just thinking as you were speaking, you're talking about completely reimagining what it means to have a constitution, not just as a country, but as a world.
Yes.
It's very profound. It's quite overwhelming. But that's what we're here for at The Verdict, is to get people listening to the big questions, talking to the people who are working on them, and ultimately, if that's not too ambitious, getting the people in charge to listen to the conversation and hear what the experts are saying about how to address these problems. And you're working with colleagues at the DSI. I'll put links to Equitas and the article that you mentioned from the New York Times. These will all be found with the link to the podcast. But just to sort of finish up here, first of all, who are you working with? What sort of disciplines are they coming from? And do you think it's too ambitious that a conversation with The Verdict, an international conversation, can nudge the UK Parliament to take note?
Yes, well, certainly the UK Parliament, the US Congress, and many other legislators and policymakers, we hope, would indeed look at these fundamental underlying issues. But the focus right now, if you look at the current version of the Online Safety Bill and you look at the Digital Services Act in Europe, are very focused on dealing with the issues without creating that fundamental backbone, i.e. due process. You can't have these substantive rights flow, protecting child, child abuse online, human trafficking, protecting your loan creators, unless you have this infrastructure. And two things that inspired me in particular were someone from not the legal discipline, but indeed one of the pioneers of the World Wide Web, the pioneer, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, in a very famous YouTube speech about 4 years ago, talked about we should create a Magna Carta for the internet. And I think that is so, so important to keep in mind. I had the fortune to work with some of his colleagues on the contract for the web, which to some degree expresses this Magna Carta for the web as part of the World Wide Web Foundation's principles in these areas. And that really exposed me a few years ago to see how important it is. Exactly as you say, there needs to be some type of constitution, but based on natural law in the sense of those principles and norms in society that we all share, because how else can we deal with these issues on an international basis? And the second point, which really was enormously helpful, as we mentioned, actually, my co-author in the Financial Times piece, is Justice Clarence Thomas's recent decision in a US Supreme Court decision where Columbia University sued Donald Trump. The case became moot because Mr. Trump is no longer president. But despite the fact that the case was moot, Justice Thomas, in a concurring opinion, decided to really express his views in this area by saying, for instance, that digital platforms provide avenues for historically unprecedented amounts of speech. And then he went on to say that the Supreme Court will soon have no choice but to address how our legal doctrines apply to highly concentrated, privately owned information infrastructure, such as digital platforms. So I think the time is really here for us all to consider how we provide the crucial infrastructure for allowing all of these important human rights in the digital world to really flourish and be adequately protected.
Wow. Well, if I were an intellectual property lawyer, I can't think of a conversation I'd be more interested in. And if I were a constitutional lawyer, I can't think of a conversation I'd be more interested in. And if I were a human being who thought that they had rights, I can't think of another conversation that I would be more interested in. So we need to continue this conversation. And we're hopeful at The Verdict that you'll join us, Dr. Mostert, with some of your colleagues from the Scholarship Institute, the Digital Scholarship Institute. And we'll provide links to the New York Times article, the Financial Times piece that you mentioned, in which you discuss some of these issues, and maybe some references as well to current bills going through the UK Parliament, which are related and of interest, such as the Online Safety Bill. Thank you so much for your time. I'm really grateful, and I look forward to rejoining you and your colleagues to keep this conversation going.
It was a pleasure.
This podcast is brought to you by the Dixon Poon School of Law at King's College London. Subscribe to The Verdict wherever you listen to your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Instagram at KCL_law, and follow the Dixon Poon School of Law on LinkedIn.